The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
A very warm welcome to Squawkbox. Really big day of news flow already and ahead as well. You're watching Squawkbox with Aramila Gamedi and myself, Steve Sedgwick. These are your headlines. Fitch downgrades its outlook on China to negative from stable, citing increasing risks to the country's public finances. Looking ahead, global equities, well, they're oscillating already as investors brace for today's absolutely pivotal US inflation print, looking for clues on the Fed's next move.
Now, the FAA has now launched an investigation into Boeing's whistleblower claims, piling more pressure on the plane maker as jet deliveries more than halve. And of course, CEO Sebastian Bazin tells CNBC the Paris Olympics is an opportunity for France to refresh its image for an international audience.
It's a showcase. It's my home. It's where we should be. Not only the best of the best, but it's a lot of people have been critiquing France in terms of service, in terms of welcoming, in terms of being maybe obnoxious, arrogant. This is the time to prove exactly the opposite.
So in terms of this Fitch downgrade, good morning to you all, by the way, which is our top headline. I had a good think about this and I thought, well, what's the new news? Where does this fit into the Rumsfeldian logic? You know, the old words, it's a known, 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 unknown, unknown, known, known. And I think this is a known known, isn't it? We know what the trajectory of Chinese debt has been for a long time. Goodness knows I've banged on about Chinese and global debt when I've looked at the IIF data for the Institute of International Finance on a quarterly basis. So we know that the trajectory on local government debt, on sovereign debt as well, we know it's been picking up as well. And to the credit of the Chinese finance ministry, which I'll come to in a few moments' time, that they're absolutely spot on in terms of, well, what's different here as well compared with Europe as well. I'm looking at the Fitch copy here as well. They're talking about central government debt increasing to 61.3% of GDP in 2024 from 56.1% in 2023. By 2028, getting up to 70%. Now, these are big numbers, big increases, but compared with the 100% plus that we talk about on a regular basis in a lot of Western markets and compared with the circa 240% debt to GDP that we talk about in Japan, they're not huge numbers, but it's the trajectory of that debt and the trajectory of the fiscal deficits that Fitch is drawing attention, and rightly so drawing attention to, but equally so from the Chinese finance ministry. One can see why they're saying, well, what's happened here? So let's go into some detail. China's finance ministry has hit out at Fitch after the ratings agency revised the country's outlook to negative whilst keeping its rating at A+. Beijing says Fitch's rating system fails to effectively reflect the positive effect of China's fiscal policy. Fitch does go into some detail on that. I've been reading it. Now, Fitch, for their part, says the revision takes into account increasing risks to China's public finance outlook amid uncertain economic prospects as it moves away from a property-reliant growth model. Fitch's revision leaves S&P, actually, as the only one of the big three ratings agencies with a stable outlook on the country. Now, I spent a long time speaking with one of the great experts on balance sheet recession when I was in Ambrosetti on Lake Como, Nomura's chief economist, Richard Koo. And we talked a lot, and I'm just going to give you a little bit of a snapshot back into that conversation, because we talked a lot about the Chinese economy and the risks to the Chinese economy.
I'm afraid that China is going through a balance sheet recession, because you're hearing a lot of people not borrowing money, government encourage banks to lend more, but they can't lend because the borrowers are not coming in to borrow. But there's one huge advantage that China has over Japan, and that is that Chinese already know about this disease called balance sheet recession. Everyone is talking about it.
Now, we've already had one stunning piece of information come out then today, and that was very important. Here's another one we're certainly looking forward to, and that is the key U.S. inflation report due later today, with the Fed said to be frustrated then in its attempts to hit its 2% target. March's inflation print is expected then at 0.3% for the headline, and core figures, which should leave inflation at 3.4% on an annual basis. Now, traders do continue to be a little bit uncertain about the Fed's rate cutting path, with just over 50% of them expecting a cut in June. That's according to that figure there, CME Fund Futures. So, what did the US markets then pretty much look like? It was a fairly mixed picture, but we've been along the flat line here in anticipation of this inflation print, haven't we? And yesterday it was the calm before the storm, pretty much the same tone then as you get out of this market picture. A third of a percent higher for the NASDAQ composite. You saw the likes of Alphabet actually reach surge 1.1%, pushing the company then to a $2 trillion market cap. Closer towards that mark, in fact, is where we saw the overall trade. Nine of the 11 major sectors on the S&P 500 also managed to tick a little bit higher, so that did pick up the market just a little bit there. On your Treasury front then, well, US Treasury yields actually fell then yesterday in anticipation of the CPI print then later today, looking for fresh inclinations on where exactly things are going to go on that CPI, on not just the CPI front, but also the rate cutting front. Is June really still the time? You've heard the likes of Neel Kashkari, the Fed president, also speaking about maybe we don't need to cut at all this year. Or maybe we need to just be a little bit more cautious. 4.35 on the 10-year, 4.738 then is where we are on the more rate-sensitive two-year note at present. Onto the dollar crosses then. And one takes a look at this as the dollar consolidated just a little bit then earlier today. It is ahead of that CPI report. Of course, it is the most critical report then. And from there, we will focus on then onto the bank numbers then as the bank earnings kick things off as well then later this week. The yen remaining just a whisker away then from that 152 mark, pretty much a line in the sand that the market is looking towards then for fresh intervention then from Japanese authorities. Not hitting that mark as yet, but as you can tell, just hovering in and around that mark. Of course, we'll look at the yuan then, of course, following Fitch's ratings outlook change then to negative from stable. And that will certainly move markets along as well in some cases. As Steve said, perhaps a known in many ways, and the market looking towards it for some fresh inclinations on what will China do next then. Onto the commodities market, and we're going to have a discussion about this as well later on in the show. We've seen record highs across the board when it comes to both oil as well as gold. Some of the other metals as well, the likes of silver, aluminium, all multi-month highs, in fact, across the board there. Another record high reached then for gold pretty much yesterday, $2,356 a fine ounce then is where you're seeing it. It's up more than $3 there. Even WTI, right? And Brent crude oil just below that $90 a barrel mark then. So below the fresh record highs that we had seen for Brent crude oil. Middle Eastern tensions still continuing to plague that price quite consistently. And uncertainty over the Gaza ceasefire talks, that has certainly pushed prices higher. Let's get into the Asian market picture then overall. And this is ex-South Korea then. That market closed today then for the country heading to the polls, choosing its next parliament. Seeing a bit of a mixed picture out on this one. Of course, the Shanghai Composite down a third of a percent, still in negative territory. Having had Fitch, of course, downgrade its outlook for the country to negative there. The Hang Seng is up 1.8%. Again, the semiconductors seem to be moving a little bit higher here. But if we focus on Japan just a little bit, a quarter of a percent weaker, we did have Japan's corporate inflation actually climb 0.8%, the third straight month of uptick, pretty much in line, though, with expectations, Steve.
Yeah, thank you very much indeed for that. Well, look, I'm delighted to say Eric Nelson has joined us, macro strategist at Wells Fargo. And I was about to launch before I got in this morning into a panoply, a plethora of questions about US CPI. But I'm pivoting quickly, as slowly as I can, to China and the ratings agencies, if I may, because I said at the wall it was in the Rumsfeldian perspective. As we kind of know this stuff as well, and they're just drawing attention to something which has been in plain sight for a long time as well. So I can understand to a certain degree the Chinese Finance Ministry reaction. But just your view, sir.
Well, you make a great point. I mean, certainly the equity flows have told the story for years now, yeah. Right? They've gotten ahead of this ratings change. You look at the growth picture in China, and it's sort of consistent with this idea that there's underperformance, right? Yes, we're seeing some uptick in the PMIs, both in the services and manufacturing sector. So much of this seems to be a little bit of a head fake, though, right? You know, U.S. goods demand is maybe showing a little bit of a late cycle bump, and it's clearly filtering through to China. But you look at the property sector in China, that is still a problem, and that's underlying our overarching view of weakness for China in the months ahead.
Yeah, and I had just the most amazing conversation with Richard Koo from Nomura, who the father of the balance sheet recession argument as well, and transferring that to China. And this was in Ambrosetti at the weekend. And I just loved listening to Richard. I could have sat there for hours listening to this just brilliant idea from him as well. Anyway, the point being is that the question is, does President Xi and the government feel able to have another huge launch of stimulus as well? Is it the right thing over the long term? Is it going to add to the fiscal woes as well? Just your views on whether the government should or shouldn't be stepping in aggressively here.
So I think in terms of what's actually needed for the economy, it's pretty clear that the central government's balance sheet needs to absorb some of this, right? There is a huge problem of local government debt overhang. And that's not going to go away until the central government really steps up. The problem is China does not seem to have the appetite to do that, right? This is not a government that sort of has the same approach that the Western governments do in this kind of market situation.
But they did do this, Eric, didn't they? Sorry, Amrabir. They did do this, and this is what Richard pointed out to me. They had a go at this in the Lehman's crisis, putting X trillion yuan into this. I think it was 4 trillion, the figure that Richard mentioned to me. So they've done it once, and it had effects, but it's also had negative lasting effects as well. So they are loath to tread the same path in order to not create more problems further down the line.
And crucially, this obviously was a huge stimulus package post-GFC, but this was not something that was really put on the central government's balance sheet, right? This was distributed via, LGFVs, local governments.
Yeah.
So I think that the mechanism is really crucial here, and until the central government really absorbs this and takes this on, it's going to continue to be a problem.
Yeah.
Let's shift a little bit, if we may, to the CPI print as well, then later today. We're already 50-50 on rates, by the looks of things. I mean, does a stronger than expected CPI print change anything expectation-wise?
I think it does. It certainly could, right? You get a 0.4 on core CPI month over month, let's say. The Fed has been telling this story that the January uptick in inflation was temporary and there's nothing to see here. We're still on the path to 2%. You get enough of these 0.3s and 0.4s, it's hard to explain this away, right? Especially when the economy is, I wouldn't say the economy is booming, but it's resilient, right? And it's just hard to cut rates if neither the labor market nor the inflation side of the mandate is telling you you should.
Yeah. Does it matter how many cuts, if they come at all this year as well, especially considering how many of the Fed leaders are already speaking about one, maybe just being a little bit more patient, having no cut, in fact?
It absolutely does matter. And it also matters when do we get the first one, right? Because the further that just gets pushed out, one meeting and another meeting, you start to wonder, to your point, will they cut? We still think they will cut. We have three cuts penciled in, in line with the Fed's projections. Question is, though, if that's not going to start till maybe July, then people start to wonder again, will that happen at all?
Yeah, I was actually just wondering as well, the strength of that U.S. economy, though, you say perhaps not booming, but remaining resilient. Inflation could pick up again. I mean, does that create a worry, like one of the Fed presidents, Bowman, actually speaking about you could see an increase in rates again at another stage? Does that fit into the mold at all?
I think it's hard to see that the Fed actually outright hike rates. And if we do see that, it's going to be a long time before we get there, right? Yeah. They can tighten policy so much simply by not cutting, right? There's 125, 150 basis points of cuts priced in over the next 2-3 years. If that's all priced out, you're looking at 5% on the 10-year again. That's going to be a problem for the economy.
Eric, you got a trade for us, or several trades. I mean, what's your favorite U.S. trade at the moment?
In the rate space, we still believe in the steepener. I think the question, of course, is, what's going to drive that steepener, right? Is it going to be the Fed cutting rates into a relatively resilient inflation environment? Yeah, that could be a different kind of steepener than we're all used to.
Or what about the kind of steepener we were talking about fiscal in China, where the fiscal supply is so gorgeously abundant that the market says, I want a little bit more bang for my buck, which I think is coming at some stage. It's just a question of when this is it a short-term or a medium-term trade?
Yeah, and there is actually some fiscal stimulus, pre-election fiscal stimulus being debated right now in the U.S., $150 billion. So, the supply argument, especially when economy is resilient, it resonates with investors.
150 billion? Just like a drop in the ocean. What are we up to now? I don't even know what we're up to in US debt. Is it? I'm going to guess 30 trillion.
That's about right. Yeah, it's getting up there.
Genuinely, I've stopped looking at my US debt clock. It's too terrifying. Lovely to see you. And thank you very much indeed for your time today. It's been a real pleasure speaking to you. Eric Nelson, macro strategist at Wells Fargo. And look, there's plenty more on the all-important inflation data. Check out CNBC.com. Elsewhere, EV sales in China grew at their slowest rate. This is interesting. Grew at their slowest rate in almost a year in the first quarter. Now, they were up 14.7% on the year, according to the Chinese Passenger Car Association. And yet sales for the month of March increased 10.5% versus the same period a year ago. Way, way slower. And yet again, another investigation potentially, trade frictions, because it's another area where the Chinese want to build up trade, of course, to offset the domestic malaise. The EU says it will investigate subsidies received by Chinese suppliers of wind turbines made for Europe as the bloc steps up efforts to protect its domestic industries from Chinese competition. EU competition chief Margrethe Vestager said the probe will look at conditions for the development of wind parks in several European countries. Moving on, Arabile.
Well, coming up on the show, Binance CEO Richard Teng tells CNBC the crypto exchange is maturing. We'll bring you that interview next. Plus, South Korea heading to the polls in a key parliamentary election. We're live in Seoul for the latest. Later this morning, we'll catch up with DTEC CEO Maxim Timchenko as Ukraine's energy industry faces continued attacks. That conversation is coming up at 9:15 CET.
Listen to CNBC's Beyond the Valley, the podcast that explores the biggest tech news from across the globe. Join me, Arjun Karpal.
And me, Tom Chitty, every week as we bring you insights into the top stories, unpack the latest trends, and find out where the industry is headed.
Now available on Spotify, Apple Music, and Google Podcasts.
I was just chatting to Arjun. I saw Arabile going to the war. I thought, oh, it's his turn, but it's not, it's me. The Federal Aviation Administration has confirmed it is investigating claims by a former Boeing employee that the plane maker ignored safety concerns around its 787 and 777 commercial jets. Now, the whistleblower says he faced retaliation after raising issues with the engineering that impacted the structural integrity of planes. Wow. Boeing says the claims are not accurate. Boeing deliveries for last month were below half the level recorded in 2024 as regulatory action and increased quality checks delayed production of the firm's 737 MAX aircraft. Arabile, it says he joins us. He's been with us all show. Arabile, talk us through the deliveries.
Yeah, so these are very interesting numbers, I suppose, overall then, Steve. This is the growing case of worries across Boeing, right, in their manufacturing. Just looking at the orders across, and one has to compare these, of course, to what we've seen out of Airbus, which has had 142 deliveries then in the first 3 months of the year. Well, deliveries year on year, down effectively on 47 there. Just March itself, you had 29 deliveries coming out of Boeing. That's down 35 compared to last year. And March orders as well, 113 is pretty much where you're seeing it for Boeing. Now, very interestingly, of course, on the back of all of this is that the FAA has essentially grounded a lot of the production that Boeing has put forward with regards to how many planes it can produce, how many planes it wants to get out there. And of course, a whole lot of airlines have continuously complained that the slow deliveries or the lack of delivery is ultimately going to slow down their ability to make the kind of flights and travels that is expected to be coming to the market then as well in the summer, especially across the northern regions then. So this is going to be quite important then for Boeing. Where do they pick things up? Does the FAA come back and say that they believe that indeed production can indeed get better because they've met all the safety checks, as it were, at present? Of course, the story around the whistleblower as well has been one to look out for. His complaint then has actually been filed or was filed back in January and then made public then just on Tuesday. It is, however, not specific to newer 737 jets. One must add, of course, the ones that had been grounded twice by the FAA, Steve.
Yeah, and look, the travails of Boeing clearly boosting Airbus. Deliveries at Airbus rose 12% on the year in the first quarter to 142. The aircraft manufacturer said it had secured 170 new orders for planes in the first quarter, compared with 127 a year ago. Now, we'll get a check on the airline space later today with the Delta CEO, Ed Bastian. You can catch that interview at 10 minutes past 1 Central European time. In the meantime, Google is set to produce more of its own semiconductors. Well, there you go, setting out the details of its new data center AI chips and an ARM-based central processor called Axion. Google hopes the move will reduce its reliance on outside vendors and enable it to compete with the likes of NVIDIA. Intel announced its own new chip, Gaudi 3. It's an AI chip, which it says is more than twice as power-efficient as a similar NVIDIA chip and can run AI models 1.5 times faster. Intel says the hardware will be available to customers in the third quarter. I just want to just take a step back. I know that we've got Arjun on to speak about Bitcoin, but I think it's a brilliant point just to bring him in on chips as well. Look, no one is saying NVIDIA hasn't got a fantastically brilliant preeminent position in CPUs and chips for AI more generally. But every day we seem to be reading more stories about other companies coming up the rails. How long can NVIDIA maintain its moat? Because it will breach eventually. There will be other players. It's just a question of how long they get this position for, isn't
it? Yeah, that's the big question, Steve. How long can NVIDIA hold that moat? There is so much innovation going on in this particular space when it comes to the hardware, the components, the chips in particular, that are going to power some of these AI applications. I think what's going to be interesting to see, and this year will tell us a lot, is how companies, businesses in particular, are going to be using AI. Will they rely on the companies like Microsoft, Amazon, Google, who themselves rely on NVIDIA chips, or are they going to start trying other ways of bringing in some of these generative AI models, which we've seen? A company I spoke to this week called Samba Nova doing some interesting things, where they've got a very small stack of tech which companies can put on premise, very small, versus having to rely then on a data set and run those AI models as well. So there's lots of different ideas and theories coming out. Which one is going to prevail?
You're a little treasure. We need to wrap you up in cotton wool, because anything I ask you as are you a little treasure.
Nobody goes.
But I mean, I do worry that if I didn't have Arjun, I wouldn't understand any of this stuff. So thank you. Thank you for that.
Yeah, let's get you on the story you're actually on set for as well, right? Binance CEO Richard Teng says the company has moved past its cultural issues into greater maturity after it was hit with a fine of more than $4 billion to settle charges from the U.S. justice system. Now, his comments do come amid a slowdown in the crypto rally this week, with Bitcoin down almost 5% from yesterday's highs. Arjun joining us then for this conversation, much like the one before.
Will's very happy of me breaking off into ad-libbing.
I'm not talking about chips, crypto, anything.
Exactly,
anything.
Right? All
the same, isn't it?
What does greater maturity mean, Arjun?
Look, Binance has had a litany of issues, and a lot of them, when you read what the Department of Justice was bringing up, was around things like anti-money laundering, but also around culture of the company. And one of the issues that Richard Teng, the new CEO, has only been in the job a few months now, is having to address is that internal culture and trying to change that. And he argued that, look, some of the problems that were brought up by the Department of Justice were when we were a startup. And now, you know, some of those issues have been dealt with. I think that, you know, it remains to be seen how effective those are going to be. So that's, you know, one part of the message. And then, of course, it's an interesting time now for Binance, because they're now in the midst of a new bull run for Bitcoin. It's a chance to now put the past behind, grow again. And that was sort of the message as well. And this bull run has been super interesting. It's been extremely different from the past cycles we've seen for cryptocurrencies. That was something that Richard Teng addressed when I asked him about his thoughts on the crypto market. Let's just listen in.
This cycle is a bit different from past cycle. I mean, you have been involved in crypto, so you know. Crypto normally go through 4-year cycle, right? Price movement cycle, which coincide with the halving, which is going to take place in about 9 days' time for Bitcoin. It's normally after about 6 months after a halving that you see a new all-time high in terms of prices. But this time around, it happens even before the halving, right? Which is why it's unique in terms of market cycle. And one of the key reasons is really the introduction of the ETF, where you bring in so many new users, new liquidity, right? I think I saw some figure yesterday that 14 billion net inflows has gone into the crypto ETFs in the States, right? So those are important numbers. But it's still very early days, because that is just the first part of it. With that, there'll be much more financial innovation, there'll be more product structuring that you come through, you see a lot more independent houses now being able to advise and their clients to do some allocation into crypto. The foundations, the endowments are going to come through. On our side, we see a lot of TradFi firms, right? The traditional trading firms, now adding crypto as an additional asset class into their suite of products that they trade constantly on a daily basis, and we start to serve them as well, right? So those will bring in new liquidity pools into this industry. So those are key positive, and we are very bullish, right, of the way forward. But we are still in the building stage, so we look forward to working closely with the rest to build this industry together.
Many have told us this year Bitcoin will hit 100,000.
Well, there are different financial projections. I mean, if you look at the Standard Chartered projection, is what, 200,000 or 250,000 by next year, right? So you have seen price point of 100, I've seen price point of 120. So all these are financial projection. What's important is we always stress to our users, do your own research, right? Just don't be led by others. Don't just hearsay from your friends, from people that think they're in the know. Do your own research. Use your own money. Be prudent with them. Invest responsibly.
Do you have a price in your head this year?
I have a price, but I think it will exceed my price.
In your own opinion, what is it?
My price last year, before the introduction of the ETF, I didn't see the impact of the ETF. My price last year is, I would have thought Bitcoin will end at about 80,000 this year. But I've revised my price upwards slightly because of the inflow that I'm seeing. So, but again, this is not financial advice. This is my own view of the world.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market moving news, you can head to CNBC.com or join us again on the show with me, Steve Sedgwick, and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.